So when it came to recording the new album, what made it different than the first one?
So it started the same way. That they were all get up and noodle on the acoustic guitar, and most of them, not all of them, but most of them were in alternate tunings.
Right.
Standard tuning, you know, is what we usually do. You alter the tunings to dad, gatter, open G, some common ones. And then some of them, I would just move the strings to something else. And so I would wind up in a tuning that I'd never used before.
Yeah.
And, it's like playing a ukulele, which I don't play, or a banjo, which I don't play. It's the same physical movements. So I can pick it up and play with it, and I have the coordination to do it, but I don't really know my way around it. So all of a sudden, unexpected sounds come out, chords you're not expecting, combinations of notes you're not used to, and sometimes pleasantly so, and sometimes not. So retuning the guitar makes it kind of like that. So you put a finger here and a finger there and strum and go, ugh, and move a finger over one fret and go, whoa.
Yeah.
And you get some combination of notes that's impossible on a standard guitar. So a lot of them would start with that. I'd play and then find another chord, and then that would imply a melody. So like the first record, they were acoustic, solo pieces. But then in thinking about recording them, I thought, I like the first record, and I like the fact that it's just one acoustic guitar all the way through.
Yeah.
But I thought, I want to do same kinds of songs, but with like a broader palette of paints.
Yeah.
So let's have a Stratocaster on this song, and maybe a Les Paul on that one. It's just different textures and tones.
Oh yeah.
And so that was a new thing.
Yeah.
To go, all right, well, so if you've got a 3-minute pop song and you're singing it, you sing three verses, the melody's the same every time, but the words change.
Mm-hmm.
If you're performing an instrumental, essentially pop song, you can't really play the same melody three times.
Sure.
It's like,
yeah, like so we get it.
Yeah. So you go, well, what do I do to make verse three still interesting?
Yeah.
So I had this idea at one point. It was like, a Beatles tune, Paul sings the verse and John sings the bridge or the chorus. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, Stratocaster plays the verse, Gretsch plays the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a different singer coming.
That's right. Yeah.
So that was a new thing to go, okay, I'm kind of handling these different instruments like there are different singers in the band. And sometimes they sing together. So that was kind of neat to think about which instrument creates the right vibe for the song.
Did you do a lot of pre-production at home, or was it kind of all?
I had the form of the song down. The recording studio in Atlanta, Jeff Bacos owns Bacos Ampworks, next to Variety Playhouse, and so Jeff engineered it. So it was just Jeff and I, and then Chris Burrows playing drums and Matt Sellard playing bass. Chris and Matt would have never heard the songs. I'd book them at the studio. They'd show up, set up their gear. Jeff would get the mics going, and I'd go, okay, you want to do a fast one or a slow one? I'd play them the song, and I had written out charts in case Matt wanted them, the bass player. But usually they'd make their own, and they'd listen, and I'd play, and Chris would think, okay, the drums might do, and he'd come up with an idea. We'd rough it out at play a couple times, and I'd go, neat, why don't you not come in there and come in there? And then we'd cut it, and you run through it two or three times until that was good, and then we're done with that song, next one. And so it'd be 8 hours of that. And I think it took 2 days with them. And at that point, all that's on each track is bass, drums, and my acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
So then I would come back and bring 18 guitars and go,
yeah,
12 string on this. And so that pre-production stuff, I didn't really have clear ideas.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to play a 12 string on this song. I think it'll be this part.
Yeah.
But then Jeff and I, the engineer, would just sit there and I'd play the part and go, that's terrible. In the context of the song, it doesn't actually work.
Got more, yeah.
But some of them, like I was saying, like one of the songs has a 4-part slide guitar harmony kind of choir in the middle. And I did not know what I was going to do in that middle section at first. I had the acoustic guitar part. I remember I was walking down the road at our house last summer just to get out and get out of the house. And I was thinking of the song, and I heard the melody that would go in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, if you harmonize that, okay, well, how would that, what would the other part be?
Yeah.
You go up a third and play that, And then, well, what if you harmonize it again? And so, and I'm thinking that through. So I would play those parts at home and make sure I knew what they were. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really overdub them at home, but at the studio, I'd play them and go, oh, that does sound like I expected.
Yeah.
So I had ideas going in, but most of the time it was have an idea, go up there and try it out. And it's always, you know, you're paying by the hour, so you want to get it done as quickly as possible.
But you've worked with Jeff before, so, I mean, you'll have a good...
It's real relaxed.
Yeah.
And he gets incredible sounds immediately. And, you know, like we were saying before, I don't want to think about what mic he's going to use or where sure. it's, I don't want to know.
Yeah.
And which compressor he's running through or what ratio. I don't want to think about any. I just want to think music.
Yeah.
And he's great at that.
That's cool.
And so we have enough similar musical background. Like there's a standard thing when you record a guitar amp, you put a mic right in front of it. And then, in the, 60s, 70s, Zeppelin days, you would put a mic across the room.
Distance equals depth.
And I never said that to Jeff. And, of course, he's like, of course I've got another mic. Yeah. I was like, can you split them? He goes, I'm already splitting them left and right. Come on.
But
I read that article.
So
like that. I would think, of course, he's got both mics going and makes me sound good and all that kind of stuff. So he was a great to work with.
Yeah. So your guys that, I mean, they just basically acted like session musicians. I mean, they came in, they nailed the parts, and that was... That's awesome.
Yeah, Chris, the drummer, can play anything.
Yeah,
I mean he's a hardcore jazzer, but he's he knows all the Zeppelin stuff and he knows them and he's and everything else.
Yeah.
But the thing I like about working with him, he's energetic, he's enthusiastic about what we're doing, but he's also very creative. And so, like the title track 11. Had this kind of, it was this kind of reflective, moody, wispy, acoustic guitar thing with this, volume swell slide, kind of, evocative melody, kind of dreamy. And so instead of playing, which would be a thing to do and probably would be the drum part I would have thought of, just because I don't know anything about it, he did this real washy kind of Elvin Jones thing. And I was like, that's why
that's
you're
it.
Here.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, and he on that track in particular, after we had done it, we're listening back to it, and he said, I might ought to change the drums. I was like, no, just in my mind, it sounded like when we were cutting it, it sounded like this three-way conversation because the drums were not in the back. And, they were kind of, it was like we were, the three of us were conversing musically, and in listening to it, I'm like, yeah, that's what it should be. This is not like a guitar showcase. This is this like mood piece.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he would often come up with great conceptual ideas like that. Most of them I would go, absolutely, let's do that.
Yeah. When you're doing overdubs and stuff on this one, were there any kind of surprises along the way? We were like, holy cow, I never thought that would just change. I mean, you mentioned with the dynamic with the drums, but I mean, anything on your end that you just thought was, holy smokes, it just completely changed the...
Pinewood is the song that's in the Rain Song tuning.
Yeah.
And I wrote it on acoustic guitar, and it's a full piece like that. And like I said, when we recorded it, it was acoustic guitar, bass, and drums, and it sounded pretty good like that. But I had this idea for a melody line, and I have a B bender. Because if you're going to do if you're going to cop a Zep thing, go all in.
Yeah.
So I had written the melody, and it's a B bender is a mechanism in your guitar that mechanically bends one string that you can't do, do otherwise. And so as I was figuring out the melody, there's a couple of places where there's some awkward things and that, but like that, I wasn't sure if that was going to be a distraction.
Yeah,
like I like the melody. I should just play it and not do this stuff, do the bender stuff. But in cutting it at the studio, I remember the day Jeff and I did it, and it was just me and him that day, and it just immediately that was like, oh, that's it. And it's so funny because it's nothing, it's nothing more than a note going, and you're like, oh,
yeah. But
it's not how your fingers would do it.
That's right.
So I remember doing that, and I think. We were laying the solo. There's two solos on that song. We were laying the last solo on it. on the fade out. And I think I had hit the Facebook Live button. Mm-hmm. So we're on air.
Yeah, yeah.
And and you know, you play the solo and then you go back and fix it. And this one, I played it and it's this long fade out. And I'm playing all the B Bender stuff and, you know, all my cool licks.
Yeah.
And there's the no quarter lick and there's that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I think I'm keeping every bit of that. And so what's on the record on the last solo on Pinewood was a first take, no punches,
oh,
just
wow.
straight through.
Yeah.
And I remember we finished it and we're standing there and Jeff, you know, you wait for him to click stop and he stops and he goes, I don't think we're changing anything about that. And I was like, I don't think so either.
Sometimes that happens.
Right.
I mean,
right.
really.
And whereas now, alternately, there's a middle solo in the middle of that song, which was exactly the opposite.
Right.
Where I probably did six passes and wasn't thrilled with any of them, and we cherry picked.
Yeah. Lick just comp them.
And
yeah.
and in the end, I go, oh, that, and I mean, if you listen closely, you can hear there was an edit right there.
Sure.
But the build of the solo that we created. I'm thrilled with.
Yeah.
But it was interesting in the same song, there's one solo that's just, you know, flat out one take and
yeah,
we're done.
Yeah.
And the other one that was, you know, cut and paste, cut and paste,
sure.
cut and paste, cut
yeah.
and paste. So, but that was a neat song. That turned out, that kind of turned into more, wound up being much better realized than I would have hoped.
Yeah. So, well, it's like when the old joke where, you know, the landscaper, you know, his yard is just whatever.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, and he's like, well, I just, you know, I don't have time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is the creative process for you? Like, when, I mean, basically your entire life revolves around instruction, guitar, but I mean, when do you carve out that time and what is that special time?
Well, I think that's an interesting thing. You know, the songs on the new album, 11, were written because, during the lockdown.
Yeah.
And so unexpectedly, not being up and out of the house and working wide open and all that, I would get up every day. And if you were around my Instagram stuff mm-hmm. at that time, you know, most mornings I would get up and get a cup of coffee, get a guitar, tune it to something wacky and noodle. And I was very surprised how often something, you know, that seemed like that's kind of a song would come out. And I'd play for 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'd go, well, let's, you know, record that just to save it. And so I would, and then I'd think, well, you know, people seem to like these. I'll put them up on the internet. So I'd put them on Instagram. And a lot of times I'd think, I can't post this one. This is not really that good. I mean, I didn't play it that well. I messed it
not
up.
Not fleshed out.
Yeah.
Right,
I mean, I literally just made it up, and this is my second try at playing it. But I think, you know, people enjoy it. It's not, they're not selling anything. This is just, it's just a gift.
Yeah.
So I would post them, and I was always surprised, one, that I had written something, and two, at the response, that people would go, I just love that one from last Tuesday or whatever.
Totally
surprised. And so after a couple, two or three weeks, I would go back and go, I don't remember any of these. I'd go back and listen to them and go, that one from Tuesday was pretty good.
Could you recognize the tuning?
Sometimes, no. Sometimes I would have to go back and go, what on earth did I do that day? And fight with it and screw with it and go, oh, the B string's a C.
Yeah.
And there's three songs on the record that are in this kind of C tuning where the low string is a C, the fifth string is still an A, the D string is a C, the G is a G, and the second string is either a B or a C, and the first string is a D. And so there's three songs that share this tuning. Two of them, the second string is a B, one of them it's a C. And so as I was relearning them to get ready to play them this summer, for a while I had them all tuned the same.
Yeah.
I was like, this is something's harder wrong. Than I remember. And then one day, I don't know how it occurred to me.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, it only takes one finger.
Yeah. I'm doing this all wrong.
Yeah, right. I was like, so, but there were times that I was like, I cannot figure what I was tuned to. Like, the song 11, mm-hmm. I was saying, it's in open G, which is very common and not that weird, except, and I don't remember doing this or what led to it, but for some reason I raised the sixth string from a D to an E flat. And I don't remember led to that, but that means that now you've got an E flat major 7 chord open, except for the second string is a B, which is a terrible note in E flat. So other than that, you have this big E flat major 7, and so with just a couple fingers, have this big cool moody chord, and you move one finger and it makes it a sharp 11, and all of a sudden, and I was like, oh, that's not open G. Like, I mean, I would never hear it and think it was an open G. Mm-hmm. And I think that one, when I was trying to relearn it, I had forgotten that I had an E flat on the bottom. So, I don't know what led to that, but I've never run across that tuning anywhere.
Yeah.
So there are a few of them like that that I think I made up.
Yeah.
And I did at some point make a point to write them down. So not forget them.
One thing I've noticed, especially in the last album, I noticed on the first one, but the second one more so, and I don't want to take away from anything that you do.
Sure.
To me, 11 is an album that I wish Jimmy Page could have made.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it incorporates all the things that I enjoy about, I mean, you know, the tunings, the textures and stuff. But it's so much more organic. It's not trying to be anything. It's just the guitar being itself.
Well, it's funny. I mean, we're both Jimmyophiles, and I mean, there's certainly textures that I'm like, I wish this song was on Physical Graffiti, or you know, I wish you know that same kind of thing. I'd be like, you know, I wish he would make a record that's like this. You know,
right?
I mean, I certainly it was like me trying to make the record I wish Jimmy Page would make.
Oh, and I mean, and that's it.
Definitely,
I mean,
that kind of.
It feels that, I mean, and not to get into him too much, but I mean, you know, everyone knows that he's been kind of hamstrung since, you know. But I mean, the Page that I think of when I think of an album like this is someone, the guy that's making, you know, White Summer, the guy that's making 10 Years Gone. I mean,
Brains, exactly.
The tunings, just the moods, the, you know. And
yeah, it's funny. There's the first song on 11, River, I wrote it in Dadgad on acoustic guitar. And at some point, I have a good friend here in town, Jim Trigg. And Jim's been taking lessons for a couple of years, and he's a very generous guy, and he had brought me two guitars in the last couple of years, and said he had come across them and he wanted me to give them to a student that would value them, but
yeah,
you know. And one of them was an Ovation 6-string. I was like, dude, that's, I'll give it to somebody that will okay. And the other one was a mid-priced Martin 12-string. And so the 6-string, we came up with the right guy for it and gave it to him, and that was great. And the 12-string, I was like, well, you know, that's kind of a specific thing,
very niche,
and it's not a beginner's guitar, you know. And so it took a while. So I had that. So I used it on the record, and on the song River, I had this melody line in Dadgad, and I was like, well, okay, let's harmonize it. Mm-hmm. So normally when you harmonize something, the standard music school thing to do is you play a note a third above the one you're playing. Yeah. Harmonies and thirds. And that sounds nice. And I remember trying to make up the harmony to this, and for some reason I played a fourth below.
Yeah.
And so I doubled the melody but a string lower on the 12 string, and I was like, oh, so now we're in fourths. I was like, is that legal?
Yeah.
I was like, it sounds cool. And ultimately, you know, that's all that matters.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I did that. But anyway, every time I hear that, when the 12 string comes in on that song, it makes me think of Physical Graffiti.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, it's just like, you know, Bron Raw or something.
Yeah,
just,
yeah, yeah.
I go, I wish this was on that side right after 10 Years Gone.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of textures and things that make me think of that kind of era and that kind of stuff. And that was one of the really, and that was kind of like we said when we started, I didn't want to make a straight solo acoustic record. I wanted more textures.
Yeah.
And that was kind of it. I wanted more colors and textures. And, you know, I think it's interesting. I play guitar my whole life. It's what I do for a living. You know, I'm completely absorbed in music and everything about it and all that. But when I listen to albums, I don't really want to hear like a hotshot guitar player album.
Yeah,
and I certainly didn't want to make that
because
that's not what I want to listen to.
Right. You
know? And so it occurred to me after I had finished it, I think there's only two songs on the album that actually have a guitar solo.
Yeah.
And the rest of them is guitar parts.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, you know, again, I saw Misha downstairs, and there are two songs on the record that are much more rocking than the others. And one of them, you know, might as well be an AC/DC song.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember writing it at home, and I was like, my heart rate was up. I was like, oh, wow, that's good. Whoa, hey. Standing in the living room playing and thinking, God. And I'm like, I don't know that I can put this on this record because, I mean, I like it, but it's, it might, you know, destroy the mood.
The flow. Sequence and all that. Yeah.
But in the end, I was like, no, because it's all part of the same, you know, variations and textures like that.
So, yeah.
But that's interesting that those were certainly some of my aural models.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just not that. I mean, like say Burt Jansch or Nick Drake, stuff like that, where it's just like, that's the kind of guitar album that speaks to me.
Well, me too. And that's interesting you mentioned them because I was like, you know, I don't listen to those guys and go, whoa, guitar lick.
Right.
I just go, whoa, what a mood.
Right.
What a sound.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and whether it's difficult to do or not, it doesn't even enter my mind. It's just that the thing comes over. And so that was very much the goal, was to try to
hang
with those guys.
You nailed it about that. Where does the title, though, come from, 11?
So that's aside from that specific title, both albums the new one and the previous one, Roots and Boughs, you know, they're all instrumental songs, so they don't have titles when you start.
Right.
You sit down
you
and
just
play,
work title,
and you go, I like this, and then you got to call them something. The first song on the album, River, is in Dadgad, and so for a long time it was just called Dadgad, and I'm like, well, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And so at some point, in my mind, and that's the one that has the 12 string added to it. And it always sort of, there's a scene in one of the in Beatles anthologies or one of the docs when they're in India. And I think they're in the, and I haven't tracked down which one it is, but in my memory, there's a scene where they're talking about them being in India and they're showing footage of them. Across the Universe is playing in the background, and they're showing the Ganges and the sunlight glinting on it and all that, and you know, Across the Universe has this dreamy melody and acoustic textures. And so in my mind, when I would play River, my song, I always saw that visual, and so I thought, so that became River. 11 is both the album title and the song title. And it, for a long time, I knew that that was going to be the, well, I didn't know that it was going to be the album title. That the song that's called 11 is the one that's in open G with an E flat on the bottom. And I didn't know, I don't remember what I used to call that, but at some point, I kind of, the number 11 started to have surprising significance to me in that, my mom passed away a couple of years ago, and in the months, and passed away kind of unexpectedly. And in the months before she died, I would call her pretty much every day, and I would get in the car and call her. And I noticed that it was almost always 11:11 when I called her, which, you know, neat coincidence, but whatever.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So then, ever after that, when she passed away, every time I get in the car, it'd be 11:11, and so that became sort of a memory.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big numerologist or anything. I don't know how that works. I know a lot of people, some people are feel strongly about that, but it kind of was this association that there's, you know, sometimes you get sort of a feeling or a gut feeling, I should do this, or I should go there, or I should call this guy, or I should whatever. And, you know, people attribute that to different things. Some people, you know, it's, you know, a little birdie told me. Some people, it's just, you know, I just had this compulsion that I was supposed to call you, or some people it's a still small voice or their guardian angel, or, you know, whatever their philosophical view. But a lot of people have referred to that, what, how did you know to show up today, and that. And so 11 kind of became representative of that. And there's a Thoreau quote that I always mangle that says something, I believe that there's a subtle magnetism in the universe that if you incline yourself towards it, it will lead you aright. And I'm like, yeah, I'll go with that.
Yeah.
I think, and again, subtle magnetism in the universe, you know, if that's God for you, if that's, you know, whatever, but whatever label you want to give it, but I'm like, lots of cultures and philosophies would have a different name for that, mm-hmm. but the same general idea.
But it's all, yeah, it's all the same idea.
So 11 for me kind of means that.
Okay.
It's like when you just keep, you know, I just keep running into the same thing, or I just feel like I'm being led to do this or directed this way. And yeah. so it, and the, to me, the song 11 has this sort of dreamy, you know, vibe. And it's interesting because we're talking about the tuning. It's a major chord, but to me, it sounds minor. And, and I've thought about that. I'm like, what am I actually doing? Because, again, in the tuning, sometimes I don't know what chord I'm playing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and
sure.
usually
yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
So I go, that's not a minor chord. That's just an E-flat major 7. So why does it sound minor? And the one of the other notes that's in that chord is a sharp 11. To run down the music theory thing, and I'm like, of course it is. And so, you know, again, you know,
that's awesome.
Make of that what you will, but yeah. it just that just seemed to keep surfacing. So the number 11 or the title 11 is really just sort of referencing that, you know, you have a feeling you're supposed to do something, you're feeling that something's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, like I know prior to, I mean, so with Roots, that was your first effort. And I mean, and you've been, you know, teaching and playing, I mean, you know, 30 years plus. I mean,
right.
what, and I remember the reasoning behind it, obviously, was Michelle saying, hey, you know, put something together.
Yep.
Why, was it a challenge to kind of at that point say, really, I got to put together a solo album? Yeah. I've never really out, comfort had, zone, all that
I
stuff.
I had, you know, having played forever, and, you know, I mean, I've made, you know, loads of records with people as part of a band, as their sideman or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
And you know, in those settings, you're making up your guitar part.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're creating musical ideas. But to completely write a song from scratch, I had done that over the years, but not very often because I just didn't have a need for it. I didn't have an outlet for
right,
it.
Right.
You know, so...
and also writing in a group's a little bit different, too. I mean, you've got that synergy instead of just going, okay, well, I got to write a song
well,
by myself.
Well, and usually,
now.
Like I say, you know, my role, as often as not, is a songwriter's, you know, sideman guitar player. And in that role... Clay's a singer-songwriter, and so you've got the song, and I listen to it, and I go, I get what you're saying with that. And then my job is to play a chord that you go, that's the vibe. That's
the song. Right.
And if I can come up with the lick or the vibe, then I've done my job. And I love that role, and that's a very exciting and creative and engaging role. And sometimes frustrating and challenging and, you know, that. But to just sit down and go, I'm going to write a song all the way through, mm-hmm. I just had never really had a need to do that. And Michelle and I were on the road in the summer of 18, and Paolo at Southern Art Dance Studio had asked me before this tour had started, he said, hey, I'm going to do a production, a dance production of Dracula. Would you want to write some music and maybe play it? And I said, I mean, I've never had any thought about writing music for a ballet or anything. I have no idea.
Right,
know.
Yeah.
But, you know, my nature is, you know, if somebody goes, hey, would you want to put together a blues band? And I'll go, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds cool. Let's try that. So I had said, yeah, I'll write music for the Dracula Ballet. And so Michelle and I were in Connecticut, and we had a day off. And I woke up that morning, and I thought, oh, I better start working on the, you know, Dracula music. And so I had an acoustic guitar, and I got it, and I thought, all right, well, Dracula music, you know, scary, but it's also kind of romantic because it's kind of a love story and you know, intoxicating and all that. So I thought, well, a waltz, you know. And so I got my guitar and I made up this little melody that was, I thought was simultaneously romantic and spooky. I thought, you know, scary love song, right?
Yeah.
And so I played it and I recorded it on my phone. And I'm messing around with it, and Michelle came across from her room, and she heard me playing. She said, what is that? And I said, oh, I've got to do this Dracula thing. And she said, you wrote that? And I said, yeah. She said, that's beautiful. And I was like, oh, well, good. That's, you know, that's what we want.
That's what we're going for.
And so at some point, she said, you should record that and make a whole album like that, and then you can open for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I had a reason to do it. And that February, 6 months later, mm-hmm. I thought, I'm going to go ahead and do this. And again, just almost as a, let me just see if I can do it. see what comes of it. And that's one of the things that's interesting to me is the state of the music industry today. We don't buy music. The public doesn't buy music. We listen to it for free.
Right.
I mean, and you know, you pay $10 to Apple Music.
Someone else pays for it.
But right. it's still none of that money, no appreciable amount of that money gets to the songwriter.
Oh, no.
You know, even with millions of plays, it just we don't do that. When the Tom Petty Wildflowers Deluxe thing came out a couple months ago, I hit the button and it's in my phone.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's 50, 60 songs, and I didn't really pay what they're worth. So we don't make money from selling music anymore, but we still consume it. And so in doing both records, they are kind of a labor of love because, you know, if they break even and pay for themselves, I'm thrilled.
Sure.
But I don't keep tabs on it and I don't keep up with it. And it's very possible that they don't. So it's like, why do you do these? And I thought, you know, to me, you know, when I play those songs, I feel better. And when I'm playing them, I feel better. And when I listen to them, I go, ah, oh. Just like if I'm listening to Pink Moon, I go, ah, oh, right. I just feel good.
Right.
And so they make me feel better. And so to do them and somebody else, like I remember the first record, Dana Miles had said she had been listening to it while she was in her art studio. And I was like, that just blows my mind. I don't even conceive, like, I wonder who's sitting around listening to my record today while they're making paintings or... But that, so I love that. And so, you know, ultimately, Michelle's statement was the motivation to do them. And so now just that people enjoy it and like it. And I, you know, I'm gratified in doing them too. That's the payoff.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's been an interesting thing to sort of develop a solo identity or, you know, and then what's that supposed to be in 2021?
You know, that's the truth.
We're not. There's no, you know. There's never going to be another Michael Jackson or another. You know.
Well, everything's so compartmentalized now. I mean, everyone's. You know, you can be the Michael Jackson of this little group.
Right.
But in terms of a general overall arc.
Well, and I think, and I'm sure, you know, I was thinking that, you know, it's like, you know, it used to be there were three TV stations and the newspaper, and so if you wanted to know what was going on, you picked up the paper or you watched the news. And so if you wanted to tell people what was going on, you had a very small number of outlets to communicate to.
Right.
And, you know, now there's 8 billion ways to find out what happened in the Olympics last night.
Sure.
You know? And so it's very hard to hit everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the same way, the last few months has been interesting for me with the album and going, okay, well, you know, you make the record, you want people to listen to it. And that's the whole point.
Yeah.
So how do you get people to... know that you have something for them to listen to. Mm-hmm. And so I've had, the last few months have been interesting in just sort of building a Spotify identity and you know, learning how to get stuff on Spotify and how to do that and navigating the waters of that. Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, Deezer, blah, 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 all the different platforms.
Like
And that's all new to me.
Yeah,
you know, so that's been an interesting thing to do that and to try to figure that. Angela Hutchins, who grew up in Noonan and was a student at musicology and later an instructor at musicology and a singer and songwriter artist in her own right, I hired her in March, asked her if she'd help me with my social media stuff because I don't know anything about, you know.
Well, you do a good job on it.
I mean, she does.
Okay.
So she's been a godsend in helping me, you know, connect to these different conduits to the public, mm-hmm. and learning how to navigate it. And again, you know, the whole goal with all of it is just to, you know, get it to somebody so they will listen to it and go, oh, I love number two.
Yeah,
that third song is great. You know.
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting exercise in that too. But I'm relieved to kind of come full circle with that. Obviously, it'd be nice if it pays for itself, and I'm certainly not opposed to making money from it, but. I'm glad that I don't need to make a living from these because I'm not going to.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to have, you know, the studio and mm-hmm. teaching opportunities and playing things to pay the bills so I can do this.
Yeah. Well, now it seems these days, I mean, unless you're going to be on the road for 6 to 8 months and sell a ton of t-shirts, making the money in the actual music itself is.
Yeah. It's all ticket sales and merch. And so you can imagine, and again, when the lockdown happened, you know, Michelle and we had a whole year of, you know, shows lined up, and of course they all, you know, fell away. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I had other sources of income, so I was okay, and that gave me the opportunity to make this record. But it is the and just the musical landscape, the business is changing.
Yeah,
as we say, we don't buy records, and so where does money come from? Mm-hmm. You know, and all that, and you know, so I'm glad to be on this end of the career span right. rather than 20 and trying to figure out how I'm going to how I'm going to be Tom Petty. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to happen. Good luck.
Man. Well, I'm thinking, is it about 30 since you moved to Noon, or when was that exactly?
I started driving down from Atlanta to teach guitar lessons in 89.
Oh, wow.
And I moved down here in 93.
Okay.
So coming up on 30 years.
Because I think you and I, we both came to Heritage at the same year. Like, was it 93?
Yep.
Okay.
I moved down here and did all that in the same spell.
Okay.
Which was a great place to be. And you know, Noonan, I mean, it's obviously grown and evolved so much since then.
Yeah.
But it's been, in hindsight, I mean, I've lived here longer than I ever lived anywhere. And I was in Atlanta prior to that. But it's been a great town for me.
Well, did you ever have any inclination that, you know, teaching was going to be the way that you were going to just make your way in life? Or did you have a teacher that kind of...
No. I don't have an education degree. I have a performance degree.
Yeah.
I remember, in high school at some point, in one class, the teacher said, okay, everybody write down what you want to be when you grow up, you know, that.
Yeah.
And I played guitar at that point, and I thought, well, you know, I mean, I want to be a musician and do that. I thought, I don't want people to think that I think I'm going to be a rock star, you know, although I would like that. But I'm
sure,
you know. but it's probably not going to happen, although I wish it would. But so I thought, well, I'd be a studio musician. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, people don't know what that is. So I was at pains to explain, you know, that those are the guys that play on the Burger King jingle or the movie and all that. But I remember in my head thinking, the only thing I know I don't want to do is be a high school band director. Because I wasn't in marching band, and I didn't dig marching band music.
Yeah,
and I wasn't, you know. And I thought, and so with the, as it turns out, I, you know, teach music in high school.
That's right.
So, but it's a very different curriculum.
Well, sure.
As it turned, and again, even teaching private lessons. I mean, I never intended that to be a lifetime.
Yeah.
But I have a longtime adult student that I saw this week, and he comments. Often he goes, well, you know, you seem like you actually enjoy this. I'm like, I do. I mean, I don't wake up in the morning and go, oh God, I can't teach lessons today. Mm-hmm. It's you're helping people, you're making their lives better,
right.
And I know the subject, and I'm happy to talk about it. I'd sure rather do that than learn about, you know, you're going to love this new true coach. You know,
sure. Oh, yeah.
I'm sure I could sell stuff and do that, but I'd have to, you know, I'd much rather sit
different
at home
frame of mind for sure. Yeah.
So, which is kind of interesting. I think you, you know, you dream of what you want to do, but we don't really know much about it. When
in how the that develops or how that...
Right. And so in the end, I'm utterly thrilled with how it's worked out.
Yeah.
And to have musicology and you know, have a demand for lessons is great. CEC is a great musical program with a ton of musical, real... Yeah. Hands-on, long time content. I'm thrilled to work with those kids. We get to play a whole bunch, you know. So I'm tickled with all of that. So it's in the end, I'm thrilled with the way it's worked.
Well, I mean, it all seems like it's all been a very organic path. I mean, it wasn't just like, well, okay, in 1995 I'm going to do this, and in 5 years I'm going to be here. And I mean, it just seems to have worked out well.
You know, I think that, like, when Paolo said, "Do you want to write the Dracula thing?" and I was like, "Yes." I'm like, what was I saying?
Yeah.
So all of those, you know, when Heritage called, you know, I remember Susie Berta called me one day, and she was the, I guess, taught lower school music, and that was all that was there. And she said, "Would you come teach guitar lessons every day at lunch to four seniors that want to teach, that want to learn guitar?"
Yeah.
And this was in 93, 90, I guess. I had decided I was moving to Noonan, and I was going to teach guitar lessons for a living, which I was already doing. And I remember, you know, and whatever, I don't remember what the money was, but it was not memorable.
Right.
And I remember she said, you know, you have to come over every day at lunch and, you know, teach these four seniors how to play guitar. And, it, you know, I said, well, how much money? She said it. And I said, well, I, you know, it's the middle of the day. I got to go over there every day. it's not enough money to really matter. I don't know. But I thought, I don't really want to go over there and teach guitar to these kids every day at lunch, but I'll tell you what, I don't want anybody else to do it. So it was almost like, you know, if I'm going to teach guitar lessons in Noonan, I'm going to teach everybody.
That's right.
And
that's
so right. That, in the same way, do you want to write music for Dracula? I go, yeah. You know, yeah. So not to keep it from anybody else, but just I wanted to take advantage of every opportunity that yeah. came my way. So in the organic sense, it was like just, you know, if you go, what do you think about doing this? I go, yeah, let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so that's, I think that's been my mindset all the way through it. And, you know, those things were not planned, but just responded yeah. to.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, it's something I kind of discovered too later on is like, if someone thinks you can do it, why prove them wrong?
Yeah,
you know,
well, no, I mean, that's a great way to say it.
Go for
yeah.
it, you know? Yeah. I mean, yeah. who knows what will develop?
Well, I remember, you know, I mean, I've played, you know, hundreds of weddings over the years, and I always remember, but I was at a rehearsal at Dunaway Gardens a number of years ago, I don't know how many, and I'm at the rehearsal, and I'm there, right, so I'll sit here, and when you say this, the cello will play, and this, and Bob Shapiro came walking over, I had my little book with my notes in it of what to do, and I had it under my arm. He walked up. He said, "I thought you were the preacher." Said, well, you know,
it's my new side hustle.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I might could be.
I'm trying to corner the wedding still, market in every.
There's still time.
That's right. I can do everything.
Right, but so it, like you say, it was like, and they're like, you know, when did I become the expert on wedding music? And I was like, how did this happen? But I've probably been to more than everybody, other than
yeah,
Bob.
I guess so. That's right. Well, when you started playing, I mean, was it a 100 city tour? Was that in 2018 with Michelle? Was that?
We did, yeah. In 2000, I started playing with her in 2017.
Okay.
Her major label band, Drag the River, was doing a reunion gig yep. in April of 17. Michelle and I have known each other since we were in Atlanta in the 80s. We were never, you know, we knew each other, say hello, and
sure,
you know,
yeah.
see each other around. And her drummer actually came from the band I was in then. He left Law. Me yeah. to go play with her.
Sure.
But she had signed a deal with Arista, and so when that band had a reunion gig in 2017, everybody wanted to come back except her original guitar player. And so she called and said, "Would you, you know, Billy had said you might want to play." I said, "Yeah, absolutely." And that was for one gig. And from there, it just evolved. Mm-hmm. She had a number of different identities musically that she, you know, works with. And so at some point, her current band, the guitar player was leaving to go back to graduate school, and she said, "Would you want to play in that?" I said, "Yeah, whatever you're doing, I want in." And that was 2018.
Okay.
And so in 2018, we had recorded an album the previous summer that came out, with Slings and Arrows, that got submitted for a Grammy nomination, mm-hmm. and we did the Indigo Girls tour that spring.
Yeah.
And at the end of the tour, which was 3 weeks up in the Northeast, Slings and Arrows was number 8 on the Billboard charts, which I'd never had yeah. anything on any yeah. chart, right? And so that was exciting and fun. And I think in that year, by the time the year was over, I think, I played in that group, and then we started doing a duo thing,
mm-hmm.
just the two of us sometimes. And then we started a Christmas band, a trio, the Hot Toddies. And so we did a bunch of that. So I think at the end of that year, we had done about 100 gigs.
Wow. Was that your first kind of experience doing extensive, like, out for weeks touring
yeah.
with the group?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I probably played, you know, 60, 70, 80 gigs a year before yeah. that. But again, it was, yeah, it was at Dunaway's, at the Alamo, it was in Atlanta, you know, but it was not getting a van and be gone for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That I had done that in the 80s, in college days, chasing record deals, but not like this. So it was an exciting thing to do. And a good friend of mine that I played with years ago that's a successful songwriter, he hired me to come play on a record last year, and we hadn't seen each other in a while, and he commented, he said, "You've had a good second act."
Yeah.
I'll take that as a compliment.
100%, man. Yeah. I mean, better than doing it the opposite way.
Well, yeah. So
I mean,
so that's been a good, good connection for us.
What was probably one of the most memorable places you played on there, like stages where you're like, holy smokes, like.
Well, I mean, on the Indigos tour, it was great because we're playing all these former vaudeville theaters.
Oh,
so
really?
They were the Alamos of those places, or the Fox theaters of those places. So we were up in the Northeast, and you know, we played at a theater in Beverly, Massachusetts, which I think is right outside of Boston, mm-hmm. called the Cabot, and it's a, you know, 1800s vaudeville theater. You know, super cool and old and spooky and mm-hmm. weird. And I remember we had the fire alarm went off during our set, and they cleared the house, and we're playing like, they're like, yeah. You have to go too.
Yeah.
And so we didn't know what was going on, except the place was on fire. Apparently. Yeah. And so we went out, and everybody had come out the side and around to the parking lot, and the stage door comes out in the parking lot. So I told Michelle, I said, get your acoustic guitar and go sing.
Yeah.
And she was like, and she stood out there in the parking lot and finished the set.
You yeah. know?
And so that was certainly a memorable night. And then yeah. in the September of 2019, we got asked to play at the Fox Theater with the for the Fox Foundation, which when they did when the Fox was being threatened to be torn down in the 70s, the Save the Fox mm-hmm. drive
yeah, sure.
managed to save the Fox, which was would be a shame if that hadn't happened. And the end of that, now there's the Fox Foundation, which will help, you know, Statesboro save its theater, or Winder mm-hmm. save its, you know, theater. And so they had a fundraiser, and Michelle got asked to play, and Drive-By Truckers were on the bill, Bill Berry from REM, and some mm-hmm. guys were playing. And as it turns out, three quarters of REM showed up, and Driving and Crying was on, and Kevin Kinney fronted REM.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they were on right before us. So we're standing in the and when we get there that afternoon, we knew Bill Berry was going to be there, and I'm standing backstage. My friend Rick Richards from the Georgia Satellites was there to play, and I love him to pieces, and he's just a treasure. And he walked in. I was like, "Oh, Rick's here, great!" And we chatted, and so then I look, and here comes Pete Buck. I don't know Pete Buck, and I'm like, "Holy cow, that's Peter Buck!" That's, you know, and mm-hmm. so Michelle and Rick know him, and so he comes over, and we chat, and I'm like, "Bill Berry's here, Peter Buck's here." A little while later, I see Mike Mills walk in. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what is happening?
Yeah.
And so as it turns out, Kevin Kinney from Driving and Crying played with them right before us. So we're standing in the wings watching the audience going, and we get to go next.
Yeah.
So that was a great, memorable stage for sure. Just to play on the Fox stage, which I had grown up going to and seeing, you know, rock concerts
yeah,
at
sure.
and all that. So that was just, I mean, that's one to remember for sure.
Yeah. What did you take on tour with? Did you take any special gear, or did you just kind of use backline, or what'd you do?
The Indigo stuff, we took our own stuff. This is kind of interesting. The first year that I was teaching lessons in Noonan, this would have been 89, a student comes in, John Hallberg. Mm-hmm. Hallberg's over in Sonoy, and John was a high school kid. Heritage kid, and he comes in, so he takes lessons, and at some point he mentions that his dad has an amplifier, and I said, "Oh, what is it?" He goes, "It's called a Super," and I said, "Oh, well, bring it in sometime." So thinking Fender Super Reverb, that's
yeah.
He comes in the next week, and it's a Supro,
yeah.
which I'd heard of, but only in those magazines, mm-hmm. and I'd never seen them, and a Supro was a kind of inexpensive American-made amplifier in the 50s and 60s. It was not a big seller. But was famously
the
whole first Zeppelin sure. album yep. and Stairway to Heaven and all that. So I went, "Oh, that's a Supro. Wow." And so John said he didn't want it, so I traded him some lessons for it. And that needed some work, but I got it up and going. And I said, "Well, you know, this is a, you know, 50s amplifier." I said, "Your dad has a 50s amplifier. What kind of guitar does he have?"
Yeah.
You know, and he said, "Oh, he doesn't play guitar." And I said, "Well, why does he have a guitar amplifier?" He goes, "They used it as the PA system in the Sonoy Rotary. Since 1958. I thought, I'm going to plug the first guitar into this thing that's ever played through it. And so that's my, and as it turns out, I still, that's my favorite amp.
Yeah, I see it all the time.
And so I took that on the Indigos tour.
That is cool.
So there were plenty of times on that, and I've used it a lot with Michelle, and it's on the album and all that. But I thought the irony of taking this 1950s amplifier on a tour of the Northeast, and it's just rocking it. Knocking it out. And at some point, Amy Ray from the Indigos was watching a sound check, and she came over to me after it's finished, and she goes, "How are you getting that sound?" And I was like, "Well, let's just turn your guitar up and turn it down."
Yeah.
And, you know, I grew up, the first amplifiers I got were, it was the beginning of the channel switching, clean channel, dirty
sure,
channel.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and that was the new thing, and that's all I'd ever done. And another friend of mine in Atlanta, Bruce Smith, that's played with the Swingin' Richards back in the day and is in the Georgia Satellites now. My favorite guitar player. He's just the most rockin', tasteful, melodic. You know, I used to go see him, and he had the best guitar sound ever. And I played with him for a while in the 80s, and he had an old Marshall, and he would turn his guitar volume on two or three on his guitar.
Yeah.
It would sound pretty cool, a little broken up, and he'd roll it up to 10. It wasn't a whole lot louder, but it was fuzzy.
Yeah, right.
So he taught me how to play the way you're supposed to, which is turn your guitar volume up.
That's what all the guys did.
Well, and I Songman's the same.
Yeah, it's
that's all that. And so now that's the I can't stand that's not so cool. do that. So that Supro is basically it sounds like a little mini Marshall. And so Amy came over. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "She goes, well, how do you get it to sound clean?" I go, "Turn your guitar volume down."
Yeah.
She goes, "So you're just turning your guitar volume knob?" I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "Ah, that's awesome." I was like, "I never would have known that."
Yeah.
You know, but somebody had hit me to it.
Yeah.
So it's a great, really responsive amp. And I love the fact that that's from here.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the background of how that came about. And that's, you know, I mean, that's what I used at the gig the other night. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's, you know, still
thing. I mean, that's, what do they say, Kitsmit? I mean, that's meant to be.
Right. Well, again, that's one of those things. It's just like you just, the with the 11 thing.
Yeah.
You know how that happened and all that came together and worked. And interestingly, I've had that Supro all these years, and I've used it and loved it. And I would play it to other people and go, "Isn't that awesome?" And they go, "Well, I'm a Fender guy, and I just love this thing." And you know, but a lot of my buddies didn't get it. And when I started playing with Michelle, at one point I walked in with that, and she goes, "You have a Supro?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "That's what I use." I was like, "What?
No kidding."
And she's got the bug too.
Yeah,
so she's like is like Supro City.
Yeah,
she uses a smaller one.
Yeah,
that's been her go to for, you know, 20 years. It's just, you know, so it's interesting when we go play, we're like the Supro ambassador.
Yeah, did you keep the original speaker in, or did you replace it?
It has the original speaker in it.
Really?
And I mean, I have. That's what, like, I was thinking on that Indigo's tour. I mean, it. You know, I mean, I've wound it up all the time, but we're playing at the Fox Theater sized places.
Yeah,
cranked. You know, and this is still the original speaker. I mean, and my buddy Jeff Bakos has maintained it.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly kept it in shape. But I mean,
it's incredible, man.
Yeah. It's and I mean, I've tried to buy another one. I have another one like it. It's a few years later. That's cool, but it's not as cool.
Yeah.
And it's anyway. It's a great amp. I still like. I'm still looking for a second one.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know. Yeah. No doubt. Well, man, I don't keep you all day, but one thing I was going to ask you before you went, I mean, I hate to go back to the influences and all that stuff, but I mean, can you pick a couple of Desert Island albums, or, I mean, what do you think?
I think the acts that I always return to, I have an older brother, and he's 5 years older, and so my musical tastes were largely influenced by him, and fortunately, he had great taste. So, I mean, you know, I have a very, very early childhood memory of seeing the Let It Be album cover on the console stereo from across the bedroom. And it was distinctive black and white and squares. And so I was always a Beatles fan and always a Zeppelin fan. And a big Bob Dylan fan. And so I think, you know... For me, Blood on the Tracks is like, I just, you know, that would be one, you know. And again, it's interesting because I think of it as a mostly acoustic record, and the textures and the, you know, I think his spirit on that record is different from other stuff.
Absolutely.
I think he'd had the, edges knocked off of him a little bit, and he sounds like it, and most of us can relate to
that. Yeah, for sure.
And then, you know, I love all of the Zeppelin stuff, and I, you know, all the Jimmy Page stuff, even the stuff that's not very good.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know, I'm an apologist. Yeah.
So somewhere on Outrider, there's a cool guitar sound.
That's right.
Yeah. But you know, but all of that stuff. But probably like that. I said that. I guess that side three of Physical Graffiti, 10 years Gone.
Sure.
That whole,
all
of that. That, and then I love all of the Beatles stuff and everything. And
sure.
The fact that they're like three or four different bands in that span of years. You know, Please Me to you know, the White Albums.
Yeah.
That's the same group.
Yep.
So I love all of that stuff. But you know, if I had to just pick one of them, probably Revolver.
Yeah, that's safe.
But sure. Those. But it's interesting, though. It's like I was a jazz major in school, not because I was a gigantic jazz fan, but you couldn't be a rock major.
Yeah.
I love a lot of that. So I love Miles Davis stuff. And again, he's, you know, there's 18 versions of Miles.
That's
so,
right.
You know,
yeah.
But I love that stuff too. I like the, you know, the late 50s Miles stuff a lot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could probably live pretty happily with, you know, whether it was Kind of Blue or something
the
like that.
The Blue Note stuff. Yeah.
Physical sure. Graffiti yeah. and Revolver and Blood on the Tracks.
Works for me, man.
I could probably be satiated.
Right on. What are your plans going forward right now?
So, again, with the change of the musical landscape, so I hope to book the band that played the show the other night, yeah. And again, build an audience for that. So, and along those lines, we're going to do a Facebook Live performance of the album. In the next month or two, and there'll be more details about when that is and how that'll work on DougKeyes.com, KEES.com. So that's a big goal. Jonathan Hickman had approached me last spring about making a documentary about music and how it's affected my life and done that. So we're working on that right now. So that's kind of neat and exciting and interesting And that's been interesting to, you know, have somebody ask you questions about, you know, that makes you have to explain, you know, when did you know this, you know, you were going to do this or when did that happen? So that's coming up. And we've done two videos for singles from the new album. The Patas Brothers shot footage for River that is astoundingly beautiful is from their More Than Just Parks series. So it's just gorgeous footage, and they were very generous and willing to help me with that. And then Jonathan shot a great video for the second song on the album, which is, what's it called? Highlands. Yeah.
That's Highlands. Right. Yeah.
And so he shot some great footage of that at the studio and at our farm. And so we're planning to do a third one. So that's kind of an interesting thing to go, okay, that's part of how you publicize a song is
sure.
you make a video.
Yeah.
So there's apparently people are much more likely to watch a video of a song than just listen to a song. And you go, I get that. So there's we're trying to decide which of the songs would be a good one to shoot next.
Yep.
And the last song on the record, Sweetheart, I love that song, and I've had a lot of people comment about it. And it's kind of a dreamy, romantic, you know, kind of 50s sounding vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, I always pictured there's just a scene in the movie Far From Heaven, Todd Haynes' movie, Julianne Moore, and where two of the characters wind up in a, you know, kind of roadhouse bar on a sort of pseudo first date, and it's an afternoon, and I always pictured that scene in my mind on that song. It sounds like it would be playing on the jukebox in that scene. So we talked about maybe shooting a video for that, and Jonathan asked me, he goes, well, you know, what would the setting for that be? And I'm like, dude, the Alamo.
Yeah.
So maybe try to pursue that, and hopefully Amy and Brett would let us have some time in there and
awesome.
I think that'd be fun. So it's just, you know, trying to figure how to spread the word.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, man, I appreciate coming by. Do you mind playing something from the new album?
Oh, yeah, right. For sure.
Thanks, man.
Let's do that. All right, so this is River. It's the first song on the album, 11. It's in Dadgad. It sounds like this.